Okay, perfect. After getting our computer ready, I would like to welcome you back to the next presentation for our track G24. I would like to say hello to Mark Ireland, FIPS Program Manager, UL Verification Services. Hello.
Thank you. So thanks everyone for joining me. I'm happy to be here today. This is the first time I've talked at a podium. Feels pretty cool. Anyway, the topic of today's discussion is surveying the physical landscape. So I'll give an overview of how FIPS approaches physical security, and I'll briefly review the physical security requirements, but I'll go over them quickly. I'm assuming a lot of you have been exposed to them already. I'll compare it with how other programs like PCI and CC approach physical security. And then we'll talk about how modules have changed over the last 15 to 20 years and how much value the current FIPS physical security requirements are providing. So what do we mean by physical security? Physical security can mean a lot of different things depending on who you talk to. So we need to define that. In its broadest terms, physical security refers to protection of personnel, hardware, software, networks and data from physical actions and events that can cause a loss of assets. So this can be protection from fire and floods or other natural disasters, burglary, theft, even terrorism. Or it could be some well-positioned wood supports. Sorry, I couldn't help myself talking about physical security and putting up a picture like that. But for our purposes, for this presentation, we're talking about protection from attackers with physical access to a device. So let's take a look at how FIPS approaches physical security. Again, I'll go over this briefly. As you're already aware, FIPS defines three different types of modules and four different security levels, and there's different criteria for each one. What I want to highlight here is basically at level one and level two, we're talking about no physical protections at all. There's requirements for using production grade components or enclosures, and that's it. And at level two, we're talking about very little physical security being introduced. So this idea of tamper evidence and opacity. So the idea here is that we're assuming that these type of modules are deployed in areas or in secure environments. It's not until level three and level four where we start to introduce the idea of penetration resistance in the form of either hard enclosures or tamper response circuitry. At level four, certainly, we're talking about an entire envelope of protection. So the assumption there is that these are deployed in more hostile environments and that the modules themselves need to rely on their own physical protections. Now, the standard introduces terms like hard or strong that aren't well defined, and in order to define them and understand the intent of the physical security requirements, we look at the IG. So the IG helps expand on the level two opacity and probing requirements for modules with fans and ventilation holes. It defines how we test tamper evidence seals. It defines how we test hard coding, so it does give definitions for terms like hardness. And it also talks about things that are outside of scope. So, for example, when we're testing hard coding methods, we know from the IG that attacks such as milling, drilling, and grinding are outside of the scope, even though these are real-world attacks that can be done with very little expertise and very little money. It also defines a level of security, physical security, in between level three and level four. So there's this idea of level three plus environmental failure protection or environmental failure testing. And then it also does a good job of providing the security assumptions described at each level in terms of the protection provided, the user assumptions, and the value, as well as the attack types, characterization, and testing assumptions. So just to expand on that a little bit more in terms of each security level and what assumptions we're making. Again, I want to highlight level one and level two, because you'll see in a minute that the majority of all FIPS validations are done at level one and level two. So at level one, again, the assumption here is that no protection is provided at all, and that any direct attack will result in access to plaintext CSPs. At level two, again, it's just very little protection. We're talking about not being able to view security relevant components, and it's used for scenarios with data of a very low value. And again, a direct attack is assumed to gain access to plaintext CSPs even at level two. So at level three and four is when you start to operate under the assumptions that direct attacks are not going to result in access to plaintext CSPs, because we're starting to introduce ideas about detecting tamper and automatically zeroizing secrets as a result. So FIPS 140-2 was published in May of 2001, so I just want to talk about how it holds up today and what we see in practice. So I highlighted the assumptions and the value at level one and level two, because as you can see here, the majority of all FIPS validations are done at level one and level two. Since the inception of the program, there's only been 20 level four validations done, and only five since 2010. Now, there are other level four requirements, such as formal modeling, that comes into play there, but the point is still the same, that what we're seeing is that the majority of validations are done at level one and level two. So how do other standards address or approach physical security? So in the majority of cases, not all cases, but most, when we're talking about a protection profile-based common criteria evaluation, we're operating under the assumption that these devices are deployed in physically secure areas. When that assumption is not made, there is a requirement that all data at rest must be encrypted, whereas in FIPS, no such requirement exists. For EAL-based CC schemes and PCI HSM, they use a costing model where each asset must be protected to a threshold of how many points an attacker would expend to perform a successful attack, where the points vary based on the asset. And the assets we're talking about are PINs or other authentication data, cryptographic keys, and other sensitive information. And the points are assigned for each part of the attack. So things like the time it takes to perform the attack, the expertise needed to perform the attack, the type of information, how many devices I need, things of that nature. So how has hardware changed since 2001, and how much value are the current FIPS requirements providing? So again, excuse myself, it's 2001, so I had to include that GIF. But so let's start by considering IC advancements relative to the FIPS 140-2 era assumptions. So the ever-increasing integration means ever smaller feature sizes to try to observe and probe. Peripheral devices are being brought inside the IC boundary, so think system on a chip, and exposing less at the package level. Multiple processors are also being brought within the IC boundary that might include dedicated security subsystems or crypto coprocessors. And then secure processors have evolved to include many different countermeasures, such as active shielding, environmental system sensors, glitching protections, light protections, and other types of fault protections that are being introduced at the component operating system level. So as more peripherals are getting sucked into the chip boundary, the PCBs themselves are evolving. So there are lower chip counts on boards these days as performance gets better, but the need to remove heat is always there, so hence the need for heat sinks and things like that. There are also aspects of packaging methods that make it harder to casually probe anything meaningful. So a heat sink might be in the way. It might be hard to get at ball grid balls underneath the package, harder to remove packaging without specialized equipment. And then if we look at the level of rack mount devices, the look of those enclosures hasn't really evolved much in the last 10 to 15 years. Most still have the need for ventilation, obviously, but certainly a lot more traffic is going through these devices. So virtualization and cloud computing also affect the situation. So for example, more devices are operating in data centers with strong physical security protections. And then counter to this, there's also an increased movement and a greater assistance for do-it-yourselfers, so to speak. So around 2001, it was much more expensive and difficult to get your own specialized equipment. These days, there's tools widely available, including open source IP cores, teardown sites, hacker toolkit distributions, and things like that. You can even get quality equipment from eBay these days. You can have your own oscilloscope. Basically, you can create your own SPA DPA station at relatively low cost compared to what it was like in 2001. So let's look at the FIPS 140-2 physical security relevance and value. So certainly the value of tamper evidence and opacity is diminishing. And in some cases, tamper evidence doesn't even make sense. So if we consider a single chip at the die boundary, there is no meaningful way to inspect for tamper. In some IoT scenarios, like car-to-car or car-to-roadside, if we're talking about an HSM, is it the responsibility of the mechanic to be looking at these devices for tamper evidence? Is it the responsibility of a car owner? So it gets a little bit muddy. And then if we look at the card identity card scenario, it's not the card itself that is the boundary, just due to the way that the CMVP typically approaches layered defenses. It is, again, the single chip or the die itself. So are you going to cut away the plastic card in order to inspect tamper evidence? I mean, in most cases, we're talking about tampering your card in order to check for tamper, which doesn't seem to make sense. Now, there are other scenarios where it does provide some value. So you can think about a USB scenario where you're checking a token for tamper. So if a token can be opened and closed without any tamper evidence, then it might be concealing some kind of snooping device or something along those lines. And then to further complicate the scenario, there's this idea of mitigation of other attacks within FIPS, but those are not characterized as physical security mechanisms, so it's somewhat of an arbitrary distinction. And if we look forward at 140-3 or the proposed 140-3 standard, there's only very little incremental updates to the -2 requirements. So as technology continues to evolve, we're going to continue to apply these same requirements, and you know the relevance and the value going forward is going to continue to diminish. So if we look at the evolution of attacks and protections, so like I mentioned, it's not surprising, but more evolution has occurred at the IC level. Chris Tarnowski in 2009 demonstrated the removal of IC layers and a focused ion beam to defeat active shielding. That was done with, it took a lot of devices, a lot of skill, and a lot of time, and certainly technology has evolved since then. But if the we have to think about key management aspects here too. So if the secret that he was able to get to is a key that's used to only unlock one device, then that's a lot of work for a very limited payback. So the art of key management includes less exposure to program level secrets. So active shielding has certainly become more sophisticated. As far as opacity is concerned, thermal imaging is used to much better understand IC design, and then synthesized logic makes it increasingly difficult to actually pinpoint IC structures. So as I was coming up with this presentation, I wanted to discuss the idea for the potential of software security to overtake and end the reign of hardware in the cryptographic module space. This is just an idea to provoke thought, but I'll offer some opinions on it. So when the standard was such as FIPS were new, most cryptographic systems were not directly connected to the internet, and threats such as side channel or other software attacks were either very new or not really known at all. And attacking a device literally came down to getting physical access to the device and attacking it. Now, physical attackers are perhaps less of a threat. There are a few reasons for this. So attacking the device directly is more difficult based on the environments that these modules are being deployed in. But the system remains logically accessible. And with such access, you have a host of other threats that are not only plausible, but in some cases, it's scriptable. So the hurdle between identification of an attack and exploitation of an attack is traversed by the ability to share knowledge and skill and leverage on the ability to clone the attacks with little or no understanding of the device. So this is combined with the fact that software is patchable. Hardware is generally not patchable, as we know. So a bug in software or a new vulnerability can be addressed and fixed very quickly, but hardware, once it's sold, remains in the same state that it was initially assessed in. So when this is combined with the increasing complexity of the systems and the increasing knowledge of the attacks, it becomes undeniable that software security is at least as important as hardware security, not because you can make software more secure, but because it represents a larger threat to the system and a greater opportunity for threat mitigations. So on one hand, the impact of cloud and virtualization pushes more of the hardware into well-controlled and secured areas where hardware attacks are much less likely to take place. But on the other hand, we have mobile or IoT devices or exposed network devices where a baseline of device security is necessary for the protection of the devices against such attacks. On one hand, we have software and firmware that are easier to modify, and hardware is typically not updated after it's once deployed, but the ease of software modification prevents additional vulnerabilities and needs to be rooted in trust. And that root of trust may still be suited for mechanisms with a hardware security basis. So some hardware protections like tamper evidence are of low value. But on the other hand, inadequate noise source is a necessary element of key generation. So the idea here is the focus is shifting to software, but hardware security still has value. And really what we should be focusing on is making sure that the next revision of the standard is one that has physical security requirements that are continuing to provide value even though the technology is evolving at a rapid pace. Thank you. Any questions?
So I have a question. So are you guys looking into new technology on processor to provide like isolation in process like SGX or TrustZone, which you kind of can provide some kind of physical isolation in logical sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think FIPS is trying to address that. They have this idea of blanking on the name of it at the moment, the secure coprocessor or sub-chip cryptographic boundaries. So they are trying to address that. I mean, that's becoming increasingly more relevant these days. And so there are ways to address that from a FIPS perspective.
Okay. So your last slide there, separating security from crypto services. Crypto services meaning when you have heavy computation, you need speed. Providing that from hardware and then mixing that with software, is that what would that add to what you're talking about here? I mean, having something like the TEE trusted enclaves that we're seeing come out in those protection profiles. I'm agreeing with what you're saying. I think there's just a mix that you're going to have here. What are your thoughts on that?
I certainly agree. I mean, the emphasis is moving towards software security, but I don't think there is. I mean, hardware security is always going to be prevalent. I mean,
but hardware still isn't going to address all of our vulnerabilities either.
That's right.
And that's if that provides the services that you need, and then you have software security on top of that, maybe that's where we should be thinking about things.
I certainly agree with that. There's no doubt about it.
Hi, I was curious what your thoughts were on the certification of FPGAs as opposed to just software or hardware, and if that's more difficult than just software alone, or does it face certain challenges?
It faces different challenges, but it's certainly possible. I mean, we have validated things at the FPGA level. There are certain aspects of it, like, you know, if the data stream is being entered at power up every time, there are certain things that you have to do to meet the integrity test requirements and things like that. But it's certainly a viable boundary, and it can be done.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that Xilinx has a guide for FIPS 140-2 certification for the Zinc products. That's a system on a chip with the CPU and FPGA running together, so they have secure boot, for example, and certain features that allow you to get the FIPS 140-2. But I'm just curious if you had any experience or if that was something that you saw with Zinc products, for example, like more modern.
I think we do have the experience, but it's rare. I mean, it's there's not many solutions out there like that. So.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm sorry. So thank you very much. That was the last question for today. Thank you very much, Mark.
Yeah.